Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 142. It's Monday, December 13th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, we hit another grim milestone this week as we hit 800,000 official COVID-19 deaths in the U.S. And of course, this is likely an underestimate. It's easily over 900,000, and we will probably hit a million quite certainly before we're done with this. It is not over yet. And of course, the Omicron variant is the big news. Let's start off with some of that. From Medical Express, UK says Omicron to become its dominant variant within days. The Omicron variant of COVID-19 is spreading rapidly throughout Great Britain and is likely to become the dominant form of the disease across the country by the middle of this month, the UK Health Security Agency said last Friday. New data from the UK confirm that Omicron is more easily transmissible than other variants, the agency said in its latest variant technical briefing. And, of course, tracking variants has been difficult, and with the Omicron, it may be even be a little bit more difficult. This story from The Guardian. Scientists find stealth version of Omicron that may be harder to track. Scientists say they've identified a stealth version of Omicron that cannot be distinguished from other variants using the PCR tests that public health officials deploy to gain a quick picture of its spread around the world. The stealth variant has many mutations in common with the standard Omicron, but it lacks a particular genetic change that allows lab-based PCR tests to be used as a rough-and-ready means of flagging up probable cases of Omicron. The variant is still detected as coronavirus by all the usual tests and can be identified as the Omicron variant through genomic testing, but probable cases are not flagged by a routine PCR test that give quicker results. Researchers say it is too early to know whether the new form of Omicron will spread in the same way as the standard Omicron variant, but that the stealthy version is genetically distinct, so it may behave differently. And of course, that UK story is a harbinger of things to come here. What happens in Europe usually comes here a few weeks later. This from Stat News. The Omicron variant can likely outcompete Delta, and that could worsen the U.S. COVID-19 epidemic. As the Omicron variant snowballs in South Africa and widens its inroads in Europe, evidence is mounting that it can outcompete the highly transmissible Delta variant, a potential warning sign for the United States. Viruses perform differently in different places, depending on what other variants are circulating and on what the landscape of immunity looks like. But Omicron is picking up speed in Europe, which has often served as a preview of what is headed the U.S.'s way. It is an early sign that the already bleak situation here may get worse. There are two possible explanations for how this is occurring, and many experts say the answer could be a combination of both. Earlier in the pandemic, with so many unprotected people out there, the SARS-CoV-2 variant that was inherently the best spreader was able to outperform other viral iterations. Omicron might get some of its apparent edge this way. But the new variant has another evolutionary trick up its sleeve, one that is conferring an advantage at this particular moment. There is such a high level of population immunity in many places that even a top-notch sprinter of a variant would have trouble finding many susceptible people to infect. Instead, the world could be at a point when the competitive advantage is transitioning to what's known as immune escape, meaning a variant that can circulate at higher levels among protected people. Delta could do this to some degree, which is why breakthrough infections increased, but Omicron seems to do this much more powerfully. Data from South Africa show a higher rate of reinfections with Omicron, and lab experiments indicate that even fully vaccinated people could be widely vulnerable to infection from Omicron. If Omicron is infecting people who are vaccinated or have had COVID-19, it means those people can likely pass it to others. Immune escape can really provide a fitness advantage over existing strains when there is a lot of immunity, said evolutionary biologist Katia Kowal of Emory University. By allowing a variant to infect people that other variants can't, immune escape increases the number of susceptible individuals. The fear is not so much about the outcomes in most vaccinated people, but that they can contribute to the spread to unprotected people or people who may not have mounted a strong defense even when vaccinated, including elderly people or people with certain underlying health conditions. Immune escape certainly seems to be a factor in Omicron's apparent advantage over Delta, but experts aren't sure how much also may be coming from it being a better innate spreader. Separating these two, separating inherent transmissibility from escape from antibody inhibition, I think that specifically may take a little time to clarify, said virologist Jeremy Lubin of the University of Massachusetts Medical School. On the evidence that Omicron is more transmissible, it doesn't mean that the virus has become invincible, it just became better adapted to exploding the contacts and the connections between us. And therefore, we have to double down and use the measures at our disposal that we already have. Of course, more of the same is what's leading a lot of people to fatigue. Okay, well, next up, similar story from Medical Express. With eye on Omicron, experts fear, quote, surge upon a surge. Harvard experts warn of a surge upon a surge in COVID-19 infections in the coming weeks. As cases involving the Omicron variant pile onto the nationwide illness and death the Delta strain has left in its wake in recent months. It comes at such a bad time in terms of the outbreak in front of us, which is truly a resurgent Delta outbreak that is reaching new heights in terms of cases and with hospitalizations and deaths also rising, said Jacob Lemo, an infectious disease doctor at Massachusetts General Hospital. What we're looking at this is a surge upon a surge during a holiday period where there's going to be a lot of gathering, and now with what is likely a more transmissible virus, and a virus that, we're now beginning to see the data, has significant degrees of immune escape. We're ready to be done with this, but we're not done yet, said Karen Jacobson, an infectious disease physician at Boston Medical Center. In a Harvard School of Public Health call, Stephen Kissler, a fellow of the Department of Immunology and Infectious Disease, said that he expects Omicron to overtake Delta as the dominant strain in the U.S. in 6 to 8 weeks. Let me read that again. He expects Omicron to overtake Delta as the dominant strain in the U.S. in 6 to 8 weeks. Answers to two important questions about the variant are coming into focus, he added. First, Omicron appears to be more transmissible, potentially much more transmissible than Delta. Second, it seems to evade at least some immunity, whether natural or vaccine-derived, meaning a likely rise in breakthrough infections. One crucial remaining question, whether it causes more severe illness, may take another week or more to answer because severe illness and death from coronavirus tend to lag reports of infection. The rise of the new variant shouldn't overshadow progress against the pandemic in recent weeks, the expert said. COVID pills now being evaluated by regulators attack mechanisms in the virus's life cycle that don't appear to have mutated in Omicron. Vaccines have been a game changer and are widely available, at least in the U.S., for those seeking vaccination or a booster ahead of holiday parties. The availability of rapid at-home tests is another boon, they said, urging people to test before gathering with friends and family. We need to really be thinking about mitigation as we had before, Jacobson said. Not locking down, but when we gather, and I think we can still gather in ways that we didn't last year, to test before we see others so we know we're not carrying one of those minimally symptomatic or asymptomatic cases, and when we don't have an opportunity to test, to try to stay in well-ventilated and masked settings.
Hi, I'm Corey the Coronavirus, and I need your help. Once I'm in your body, I can multiply a gazillion times, but I need your help with my travel plans. I am already a worldwide traveler, but I would love to meet up with you. At your workplace, out in public, with your friends, anywhere. I'll gladly meet you at your home if you let me. Hey, look, you don't even have to touch me. I understand, because I do give a flying leap. Look, I know I'm nothing special. Most people get over me, but the odds are that someone you know may just be dying to meet me. And those conspiracy-loving friends of yours? Come on, you know you've got some. I'd love to meet them, even if they don't believe my travel plans. In reality, in their presence, I am inspired over and over and over again. Breathe it in, folks. What you believe doesn't really matter to me. I'm just that kind of guy. Well, I've got to get going. I'm really making the rounds these days. Hey, keep in touch. And I really do mean it. But if I don't run into you soon, remember, I'll be back.
This message has been brought to you by Pandemic Travel Bureau. We only go where you have already been, which is why the price you pay to travel with us is never really worth it. Please note, the purchase of any travel plan does not include 6-foot pole.
Okay, well, one thing we're waiting to find out with the Omicron variant is how well vaccines protect against getting infected. This from Science Daily. Vaccines and previous infection could offer some, quote, stronger than basic protection to Omicron, early study suggests. Published today, one of the earliest peer-reviewed studies looking into the Omicron variant of COVID-19 suggests that people previously infected with COVID-19 and those vaccinated will have some, quote, stronger than basic defense against this new strain of concern. I'm not sure what stronger than basic means, although I think another less optimistic phrasing might be more than nothing. In other words, some protection. Okay. However, the test tube or in vitro scientifically samples of Omicron examined in this new research do show it, quotes, exceeds all other variants in its potential capability to evade the protection gained from previous infection or vaccination. Published in Emerging Microbes and Infection, the findings also suggest that although a third dose enhancement strategy can significantly boost immunity, the protection from Omicron may be compromised, but more research is needed to better understand this. Stay tuned. But of course, with increased infectiousness, we need to do more than just vaccines. This from Medical Express. Vaccines are necessary, but not sufficient without better healthcare and ventilation. A high vaccination rate is the foundation of any pandemic policy, but further protection is still needed. From an economic perspective, that protection comes from more investment in healthcare and air quality, which now seem essential complements to vaccines and face masks. So what can be done? Besides getting that third shot into as many arms as possible, we can, first of all, boost healthcare itself. Since the crisis could last for years and we don't know what other crises lie ahead, this can be seen as valuable insurance. In the Netherlands, for example, vaccination coverage is as high as in Belgium, 75% of the total population, but ICU capacity is lower, only slightly lower than in the UK, which partially explains why Belgium was able to avoid a stricter lockdown last month. Such a safety net then consists primarily of sufficient ICU, acute care, vaccination and testing capacity, but certainly also of more support from general practitioners and long-term care, since everything is connected. As much of the current pressure on healthcare systems is due to absenteeism, protecting the mental health of healthcare workers and giving them a pay raise would be a quick win. Making tests freely and widely available across Europe to boost testing capacity as the UK has done is another. All in all, boosting healthcare can be seen as a productive investment, as it gives us more of a buffer before having to shut down schools or parts of the economy. Subsidies to improve air quality could be a second strategy. Why not make this compulsory for all large office buildings and schools, and organize checks on CO2 meters in the hospitality industry, for example? We have known for more than a year that the virus is also spread through the air, especially in enclosed spaces where the aerosol cloud can build up just like cigarette smoke. So places need to be well ventilated. A recent study shows that indoor CO2 monitoring reveals to be a practical proxy for SARS-CoV-2 transmission risk. Better ventilation and air filters are a logical solution. Working with air filters is surprisingly cheap and flexible and is a quick fix, while retrofitting existing buildings with better ventilation is more cumbersome and costly. But even this would be a clear win in the long run, since studies show that well-ventilated spaces make for a better learning environment or workplace. Better air means fewer respiratory illnesses in general, so this investment would also increase our productivity in normal times. Given that these are all productive investments, we can use our remaining fiscal flexibility to finance them. The benefits will outweigh the costs, which are still peanuts compared to the huge sums of state aid given to companies in the form of grants and loans during the pandemic, partially propping up, quote, zombie companies. The latter was a necessary evil, a side effect from saving entire economies from the brink of the 2020-2021 pandemic. But now the time has come to gradually phase out this support and invest in strategies for the future. Working from home. But even if we go for all these investments, we're not out of the woods yet. To fully eliminate the lockdown risk, we need to be able to switch up remote working relatively quickly. If the figures rise above a certain level, remote working could become the norm. When the benefits of a policy outweigh the costs in any conceivable scenario, there is little reason not to do it. If politicians want to regain the trust they have lost along the way, showing us they can do the math will restore our confidence in their competence. Okay, and this next story highlights how healthcare is, of course, a main infrastructure backstop for the worst of this pandemic. This from Medical Express. Pandemic nurse shortage. Kentucky governor declares an emergency. Kentucky's governor declared the state's chronic nursing shortage to be an emergency last Thursday, taking executive actions amid the ongoing coronavirus pandemic to boost enrollment in nurse training programs. Kentucky is projected to need more than 16,000 additional nurses by 2024 to help fill gaps caused by retirements and people leaving the profession, Governor Andy Beshear said. His new executive order includes immediate actions that we believe will provide some relief, the Democratic governor said. Obviously, long-term, there's a lot to do. The nurse staffing emergency in Kentucky reflects a national epidemic created by the pandemic. Health leaders say the problem is twofold. Nurses are quitting or retiring, exhausted or demoralized by the crisis, and many are leaving for lucrative temporary jobs with traveling nurse agencies. Some severe shortages threaten not only the health of patients, but the entire healthcare delivery system. He added that Kentucky is operating 12 to 20% short of, quote, needed nursing volume. His executive orders aims to get more students into Kentucky nursing programs. It requires the State Board of Nursing to approve requests for enrollment increases from schools that show sufficient resources to accommodate more students, he said. Nursing schools will be expected to report the number of vacant student slots to the State Nursing Board each month. Those vacancies will be posted on the board's website to let prospective students know that where spots are available. The order aims to allow nursing schools to open new campuses more quickly, provided they have sufficient resources. Nursing schools at full capacity will be required to refer qualified student applicants to other schools with vacancies, he said. And schools unable to accommodate their full student capacity due to staffing shortages will be expected to notify state officials with the goal of helping them hire more faculty. Also, an advisory committee will be formed to offer additional proposals to overcome nursing shortages. The governor also signaled that his upcoming state budget package will include proposals to attract and retain nurses. His plan will include some form of loan forgiveness or scholarship program for nurses who agree to remain in Kentucky for a designated amount of time. The governor will present his budget plan to the Republican-dominated legislature in early 2022. Also, nurses who work throughout the pandemic will be included in his proposal to award essential worker bonuses. Beshear said he wants to use $400 million in federal pandemic aid to award the extra pay to a range of frontline workers employed throughout the pandemic. Beshear made another pitch for the bonuses in hopes of winning support from GOP lawmakers. This isn't about process. This isn't about party, he said. This is about the people that have kept us alive, kept us safe, kept us healthy, kept us fed, kept us safely in our homes with our lights and our heat on during this pandemic. Saying no to this program is saying no to them. It's the second straight day the governor took executive action to confront a nagging state problem. Last Wednesday, Beshear awarded a 10% pay raise to Kentucky's social service workers. The pay boost is aimed at halting the widespread loss of frontline employees demoralized by low salaries and bulging workloads who are serving vulnerable children and adults. The pay increases take effect December 16th for social workers and family support services staff, the governor said. It's a result of this action to reclassify their jobs to a higher grade. Infrastructure matters, people. Okay, well, this next story from Stat News gets at the fact that some success actually leads to some new problems, and this is a big one in tracking the pandemic. Growing use of home COVID-19 tests leaves health agencies in the dark about unreported cases. It's a story that's becoming commonplace in the era of rapid home COVID tests. People who test positive are almost never counted by public health agencies charged with bringing the pandemic to heel. While home tests have distinct advantages, they're convenient and quickly inform people of their infection status so they can take steps to avoid spreading the virus, most who test positive don't come to the attention of health officials unless they are sick enough to see a doctor. Complicating matters is that health agencies have little idea how many home tests are performed in their states and communities, and thus how many results they're missing. Indications are that home testing nationally has already surpassed the number of the standard PCR tests, which are processed by labs that are required to report results to health agencies. In contrast, most of the home tests have no mechanism to enable patients to easily report their result. Only two of the approved home tests include an app to report results, and it's unclear whether those are used in most states. Most people are also too busy to bother. And the CDC last month dropped guidance urging users of home tests to report results to public health agencies. Mara Aspinall, managing director of Health Catalyst Group, an Arizona-based consulting company that focuses on life sciences firms, has been tracking testing data using industry reports, test production numbers, and a host of other sources. It's nearly impossible to get a precise read on exactly how many home tests are used in the U.S. each week, but her best estimates show that home testing now accounts for the majority of COVID testing, and the number will grow as more tests become available. Aspinall says by her tally, roughly 40 million COVID tests are performed each week. Of these, she estimates 12 million are PCR tests, and roughly 28 million are antigen tests. That means there's more than twice as many of these home tests versus the standard PCR tests. Woo! That means over two-thirds of the tests fall in this category where reporting is non-existent or very low. Among the antigen tests, the vast majority are taken at home and never reported to public health agencies, she said. We believe that continuing to make testing available, both proctored and unproctored, is valuable for multiple reasons, Alicia Schultz, spokesman for the Ohio Department of Public Health, said in an email. To the extent more people are testing and reporting their results, it gives us a better, though admittedly imperfect, sense of our overall case rates. And even when people don't report, they're using their test results to inform their behavior regarding going to school or work, going to visit relatives. So these tests can help slow community spread and protect vulnerable residents. But as far as like the reporting that I do and others do, when we talk about the levels of the infection rates in community, it's probably currently, when you're looking, trying to compare it historically, like say over last summer or even like last winter surge, if you have equivalent rates of identified cases, likely now the actual infection rates are higher because so many of these positive tests are not actually being reported when previously virtually all of them would have been. And of course, all through the pandemic, there's many people who get symptoms and have a quote presumptive COVID-19 case but never get tested by any means. Okay, well, let's look locally and do the Lucas County COVID-19 update. We'll start with a story here to get us rolling, provided by Toledo WTVG. Hospital COVID cases jumped 50% in the last 2 weeks. The number of COVID cases for Lucas County is deeply concerning. Mercy Health Dr. James Tita says, the latest numbers show that our COVID cases have increased 50% over the last 14 days. This was reported last Thursday, so this is actually a little bit old, but that is a pace that is not sustainable and leaving patients waiting for hours for beds in area ERs. ICUs are full as well as acute care beds. That is trouble, my friends. Lucas County Health Commissioner Dr. Eric Zizinski says the health department and area hospitals have been in contact with the state to assess backup resources if they need them. These conversations have been had for a couple of weeks now, just trying to figure out what we do and how do we do it, he said. Conversations have been had with the Ohio Department of Health. That's my connection to it about the National Guard. Well, reported cases in Lucas County actually went down a little bit from 262 per day on average to 233. Testing positivity locally went down from 16.9% to 15.4%. This is very high, although locally we had a large increase in the amount of testing done, which is good to identify more cases. But of course, if you're doing a lot more testing, you're likely to catch a few more tests, and the proportion of total tests will be edging down. And 15% positivity rate is really high. And it's very similar in the state, which edged up 0.1% to 15.6%. In the U.S., the testing positivity rate dropped a bit from 8.3% to 7.6%. So that's a good trend. Nursing homes in Lucas County, long-term care, we had a slight drop in the number of active cases from 76 down to 65. That was 38 residents and 27 staff. And we had one more death among long-term care residents. In schools, we're seeing the tick up locally again. We went from 65 staff to 77 staff in the most recent week with COVID-19 infections, and we bumped up from 253 students to 274 students identified. And something interesting in the state, last week we actually had a significant decline in number of staff and students identified statewide with COVID-19. But compared to 2 weeks ago, we've had a huge increase. It jumped way up this week. So from 2 weeks ago to this most recent week, we jumped from 1,075 staff to 1,503 staff statewide, and from 5,392 students to 7,198. So almost a 50% increase statewide over the last couple weeks in students identified with COVID-19. In UT, we saw another little bump up. They're already reached their point where vaccines are mandated there, but they had 67 identified cases, and they're seeing about 1.5% of their surveillance testing, which is the random testing among their University of Toledo population, and that's been holding relatively steady. So it's still going along at UT. And of course, hospitalizations as a whole are continuing to rise in both Lucas County and Ohio. Deaths nationally are cruising at over 1,100 deaths each day, and that looks like that's going to go on the rise. Okay, a little bit of better news in looking at those that are fully vaccinated. We actually saw a 1% increase in the United States, meaning 1% of the entire U.S. population moved into fully vaccinated status last week. So that's a big reversal. So it looks like the surge that we're in now is motivating at least some people to complete their vaccinations. And we had a 0.7% increase in Ohio, up to 54.1% of the total population fully vaccinated. Slightly behind that, Lucas County had 52.8% of its entire population vaccinated. You are listening to WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo, We Act Radio. Just for the health of it is the People's School of Public Health, in the University of Life. Well, folks, we live in sort of crazy times, and this next story is very interesting. It's kind of a public health case study in how everything is connected. So here we go from the LA Times. Car crash deaths have surged during COVID-19 pandemic. Here's why. It was a tally that shocked the experts. 38,680 deaths on U.S. roadways last year, the most since 2007, even though pandemic precautions had dramatically reduced driving. This was completely unprecedented, said Ken Kolosch, a researcher at the nonprofit National Safety Council. We didn't know what was happening. One possibility was that stressed-out Americans were releasing their anxieties on the wide open roads. He guessed that fatal accidents would decline in 2021 when traffic returned. He was wrong. The latest evidence suggests that after decades of safety gains, the pandemic has made U.S. drivers more reckless, more likely to speed, drink or use drugs, and leave their seatbelts unbuckled. I fear we've adopted some really unsafe driving habits, and they're going to persist, Kolosch said. Our roads are less safe than they were pre-pandemic. Experts say that this behavior on the road is likely a reflection of widespread feelings of isolation, loneliness, and depression. We might decide, what does a seatbelt or another beer matter anyway when we're in the middle of a pandemic, said Shannon Frateroli, a researcher at the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. The rise in motor vehicle deaths line up with other pandemic-era trends. Alcohol sales have soared, drug overdoses have set new records, and homicides have seen their biggest increase on record. COVID-19 marks a sea change in psychology, said Frank Farley, a professor of psychology at Temple University, who views reckless driving as a form of rebellion, or what he calls, quote, arousal breakout. You've been cooped up, locked down, and have restrictions you chafe at, he said. So if you could have an arousal breakout, you want to take it. Before the pandemic, safety on U.S. roadways had been improving for decades, thanks to enforcement of seatbelt laws and the advent of airbags, improved braking and stability control, and other safety features. Even as the number of people on the roads increased and many states raised their speed limits, annual fatalities fell from around 55,000 in 1970 to just over 39,000 in 2019. Then came a 7.2% rise in 2020, followed by an 18% jump in the first 6 months of this year, based on preliminary figures from the federal government. What made last year's increase so astonishing was that the total miles driven an estimate calculated by sampling traffic on various roadways, fell by over 13% as cities locked down and more people worked from home. For every 100 million miles driven last year, 1.37 people died, a 23% rise from 2019. Mileage estimates are not yet available for 2021. Scattered across the country at a time when the nation's attention is on COVID-19 deaths, traffic fatalities have attracted little public notice. Left to probe the statistic, researchers are struggling to attribute the rise in deaths to any one factor. Fatalities are up in cities and rural areas. They spiked on highways and back roads. They've risen during the night and the day, weekdays and weekends. They've climbed in every age group between 16 and 65. Still, some patterns have emerged. Chief among them is that the death rate for black people rose more than 3 times faster than the death rate overall, a disparity that could reflect a deeper sense of despair in the poorer communities hit hardest by the pandemic. Frattarelli wondered whether it was related to a disproportionate number of black people in the essential workforce, including delivery drivers who are paid by how fast you can move. In one of the clearest indications of rising recklessness, fatal accidents involving only one vehicle also rose disproportionately. The data also show an outsized increase in deadly accidents involving speeding, illegal substances, or a failure to wear a seatbelt. Jonathan Adkins, executive director of the Governor's Highway Safety Association, a Washington nonprofit representing agencies nationwide, suggested that people's disregard for themselves and others on the road is part of a national decline in civility that accelerated during the pandemic. Research based on crash investigations has shown that even a slight increase in speed, say from 50 to 56 miles per hour, is enough to increase a driver's risk of death. Since the start of the pandemic, a larger share of accident victims, including those who survived, have been ejected from their vehicles, typically because they were not wearing seatbelts. The increase in ejections was seen just as lockdowns began last year. Men have accounted for a disproportionate share. Federal researchers who looked at accidents in which drivers were killed or seriously injured found that the proportion who tested positive for opioids nearly doubled after the pandemic began. Marijuana use also rose considerably. Finally, more drivers are distracted. Researchers using GPS and other data determine that drivers use their phones more frequently after the pandemic began and that the problem only worsened over time. And this next story shows what may be another aspect of pandemic fatigue, this from patient engagement. Fewer people recognize health disparities, inequities as a problem. The number of folks recognizing racial health disparities went down by more than 8 percentage points, Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and RAND Corporation polling shows. Particularly, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation researchers saw a significant decline in the number of people recognizing health disparities between July 2020 and September 2021. In July 2020, 61.1% of U.S. adults agreed that people of color face a disproportionate health impact from the COVID-19 pandemic, and 57.5% agreed people of color face more of a financial impact than their white peers. By September 2021, however, those numbers had shrunk. Only 52.7% of adults agreed populations of color saw a stronger health impact from the pandemic, and 50.3% agreed populations of color saw a bigger financial impact. This comes even as the evidence grows that the COVID-19 pandemic exacerbated existing racial health disparities, which are often fueled by systemic inequities and racism in medicine. The initial COVID-19 outbreak, paired with social unrest sparked by the killing of George Floyd, fueled a social movement which included a close look at how racism impacts healthcare, the researchers said. However, this latest data shows that the momentum may have been lost. We conducted the survey because we wanted to see whether living through a once-in-a-century global pandemic would spur a shift in deep-seated perspectives and attitudes around health, systemic racism, and equity, Anita Chandra, Vice President Senior Policy Research at RAND Corporation, said. We found that views around race and racism appeared to be extremely entrenched. Moving forward, policies and actions that seek to address these issues must factor in where the public is and what needs to happen for these sentiments to evolve. The survey showed that fewer people recognize the link between systemic racism and health outcomes. For example, the researchers reported a 3% decline in the number of people who agree poor health outcomes are related to systemic racism. Only about 40% of respondents in September 2021 said they agreed health outcomes could be linked to systemic racism. Obviously not people listening to my show. Black and Latino respondents were more likely than white respondents to agree that systemic racism had an impact on health outcomes. Rather, more attention is being paid to how income and other social determinants of health, like rurality, impact health outcomes. In September 2021, 63.8% of respondents said it was harder for low-income people to access care, and another 63.5% agreed it was hard for those living in rural areas to access care. Meanwhile, fewer than half thought of it being Black, 44.4%, or Hispanic, 42.4%, made it harder to access health care compared to white people. To be clear, these demographics are complex and is not a zero-sum game. Income, rurality, and race are all social determinants of health that make it difficult to access health care, and people can experience more than one of those social determinants of health. These declines in understanding health disparities notwithstanding, the polling did indicate some hope for the future. 68% of respondents still agreed the pandemic could be a launching pad for positive change, and nearly a quarter of people agreed care access needs to be a priority for that change. Additionally, healthcare policymakers are still prioritizing racial health equity, regardless of how much the public acknowledges the link between outcomes and systemic racism. Okay, well, next up, we've got some new research that really probably puts to rest that whole argument of between public health and economics, or dealing with COVID-19 and dealing with health overall. Some critics of stringent COVID-19 control measures thought that it would result in a greater amount of health problems overall, but that doesn't seem to be the case. This from Medical Express. And this comes out of China, which did the most severe lockdowns of any place in the world. Did the lockdown lead to more or fewer non-COVID deaths? Using death registry data that covers one quarter of the Chinese population, the research team compared non-COVID mortality before, during, and after the lockdowns between two groups of cities, those with strict anti-contagion policies and those without. They found that lockdown measures reduced the number of deaths from other causes by 4.6%, preventing 54,000 deaths from other causes during the initial 50 days of strict lockdown. Surprisingly, the health benefits became even greater after the lockdown policies loosened. Mortality from other causes decreased 12.5% in the 115 days after the lockdown, leading to 293,000 lives saved across the country from non-COVID deaths. To understand why, Dr. Guozhen He and his co-founders found that less traffic and industrial activities led to less air pollution, in turn leading to large drop in cardiovascular disease deaths. Areas that were initially very polluted saw the greatest improvement, suggesting better air quality can be vital in preventing premature deaths. Social distancing and an increase in sanitizing surfaces, hand washing, and mask wearing also contributed to fewer deaths from other infectious diseases. Our research also points to the direction of improved population health after the lockdown measures are lifted, said Dr. Hay. If the government continue its efforts to control pollution and the public are willing to keep good personal hygiene, these short-term benefits will become long-lasting. Well, another takeaway you can get from this is that, in fact, high levels of economic activity, which produces a lot of pollution, is, in fact, bad for our health. And when those large industrial commercial activities are slowed down, you actually see improvements in health. Yes, sir, capitalism kills us. And this is proved even in the so-called communist state of China. Well, a big question in all this is, will we learn from all these potential lessons learned? Perhaps not. This from Medical Express. Report finds world ill-prepared for next pandemic. The world isn't ready to prevent or deal with another pandemic because many nations aren't taking the necessary steps to prepare for what is likely an inevitable future scenario, a new report shows. The Global Health Security Index, an assessment of preparedness for various health emergencies and problems, is produced by the Nuclear Threat Initiative, Economist Impact, and the John Hopkins Center for Health Security at the John Hopkins School of Public Health. The 2021 Global Health Security Index continues to show that all countries still lack some critical capacities, which hinder their ability to respond effectively to COVID-19 and reduces their preparedness for future epidemic and pandemic threats. The average score in 2021 was 38.9 out of 100, which is essentially unchanged from 2019, the report found. The United States did have the highest overall score at just under 76. Woohoo! Go U.S. Preparedness in preventing the emergence of new pathogens was the area with the lowest worldwide score. Within the past 3 years, 155 out of the 195 countries in the survey didn't invest in preparing for a pandemic or epidemic, and 70% didn't invest in clinics, hospitals, and community health centers. Leaders now have a choice, says Dr. Jennifer Nuzzo, senior scholar at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. They can make dedicated, sustainable investments in the new capacities created during the COVID-19 response to prepare their countries for the long term, or they can fall back into the decades-long cycle of panic and neglect that will leave the world at grave risk for inevitable future public health threats. The document also said that people in 161 countries have low to moderate levels of public confidence in their government, a key factor among countries with high number of COVID-19 cases and deaths, and that the United States had the lowest possible score in that area. Such lack of confidence can undermine public adherence to disease control measures, such as wearing masks or complying with stay-at-home recommendations or vaccination protocols, which have been reported among the ongoing challenges to the U.S. COVID-19 response. Over nearly 2 years, U.S. politicians have questioned the motives and messages of health officials and debated the seriousness of the virus and the effectiveness and safety of vaccines. The result? In many areas of the country, people have been unwilling to comply with public health recommendations that would slow the spread of the virus. Other weaknesses in the United States, including limited access to health care without cost barriers and low numbers of health care personnel and hospital beds per capita that many other high-income countries have, the report found. Okay, let's shift gears a little bit and do a couple mental health stories. This from Medical Express. Review finds significant barriers in shift to remote mental health services during pandemic. The benefits of remote care include increased convenience and accessibility for staff and patients and reduced travel costs. Additionally, some studies reported that more family members were able to attend family therapy or family education sessions since care has moved online. However, the shift to telemental health also presented challenges, such as difficulties on picking up on nonverbal cues and establishing a strong therapeutic relationship. While the studies came from a variety of higher-income countries, similar challenges tended to be experienced. The study found that remote care was deemed less acceptable and presented more challenges for certain groups, including new patients, service users without a private space at home for therapy, service users with a schizophrenia diagnosis, severe anxiety or learning disabilities, children, older adults, and those from lower socioeconomic backgrounds. The review also concluded that the majority of service users and clinicians wanted at least some appointments to be face-to-face once restrictions on in-person contact due to the pandemic had loosened. And, of course, internet usage has increased as we've all been kind of stuck at home more during the pandemic. This from Medical Express. Researcher finds the pandemic led to increase in internet addiction among American adults. The study findings published in Psychiatry International showed 45% of the participants had no internet addiction. However, 41% had probable addiction or were at risk for addiction, while the remaining 14% had definite or severe addiction. The following behaviors indicate addiction and dependence. Quote, I use internet devices longer than I plan to. I routinely cut short my sleep to spend more time online. I felt restless, tense, frustrated, or irritated when I could not use the internet or use it as long as I wanted to. Compared with participants who did not have an internet addiction, those who had probable addiction were 2.3 times more likely to have depression and almost 2 times more likely to have anxiety. In contrast, individuals who had definite or severe addiction were almost 10 times more likely to have depression and about 9 times more likely to have anxiety and over 13 times more likely to have both depression and anxiety. Before the pandemic, evidence suggested that the prevalence of internet addiction in American adults was an average of 8% of adults seriously addicted at any given time, compared to the current research, which shows about 14%. Okay, well, let's do a couple stories about medical care that show some weaknesses in our national public health. This first one from Science Daily. A third of U.S. kids lack good and consistent health care. In a concerning trend for the health of U.S. children, the rate of underinsured youngsters rose from 30.6% to 34%, an additional 2.4 million kids from 2016 to 2019, according to an analysis led by the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. In the study, published in Pediatrics, the researchers found that underinsurance of children was mainly driven by increased rates of inadequate insurance rather than a rise in absent or inconsistent insurance. Notably, they found families who have children with special health care needs and private insurance were hit particularly hard. The main takeaway is that the insurance landscape is getting bleaker, and it's hurting millions of families, specifically those who are most vulnerable, said Justin Yu, lead author of the study and assistant professor of pediatrics at Pitt School of Medicine. We need pediatric organizations and politicians to bring child health insurance to the forefront and make it a priority issue. The increase in underinsured children was driven by rising insurance inadequacy, mainly experienced as high out-of-pocket expenses for health services. According to the researchers, this is concerning because high fees may force families to delay or forego care for their children. The researchers suspect that the rise of unreasonable out-of-pocket expenses reflect broader trends in the insurance landscape. Insurers are increasingly transferring costs to individuals and families through higher co-pays and premiums, and increasingly through high deductible plans. These trends may help explain the finding that children with private health insurance were more likely to be underinsured than those on public plans, such as Medicaid or the CHIP program, Children's Health Insurance Program. Another notable finding was an increase in the rate of underinsurance in kids considered to be more sociologically advantaged, white children from middle-income, highly educated families. We have this idea that if you have a full-time job with health insurance from your employer, that your health care needs will be met. But our data show that increasingly that's not the case, especially for families who may be enrolled in lower premium, high deductible plans. The researchers also examined underinsurance rates in children with chronic health conditions. They found that kids with more complex special health care needs were more likely to be underinsured than those with less complex or no special health needs. This is worrisome because, by definition, these children need the most health care. According to the researchers, tackling the problem of child underinsurance may require large-scale policy reforms, such as broadening eligibility for Medicaid or creating a universal health insurance program for all U.S. kids. But smaller policy changes, such as making it easier to apply for and stay on Medicaid or cash assistance programs to help cover out-of-pocket expenses, also could help. Well, folks, sounds like a clarion call for health care for all, a national health program.
It started in Norway in 1912. And they won't stop until everybody has healthcare. The infestation of healthcare for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and co-pays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get health care whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without health care. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
Okay, well, this next story shows that having rules and regulations don't necessarily translate into compliance. So we have a new regulation here that's having low compliance. This is from Medical Express. More than half of U.S. hospitals not in compliance with new pricing disclosure rules in first 5 months. A study led by researchers at the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health that examined U.S. hospital compliance with new rules requiring hospitals disclose prices found wide fluctuations across states, with some states achieving 75% or higher compliance and others coming in at 25% or lower. Taken together, more than half, 55% of U.S. hospitals were not compliant with a new federal rule that went into effect January 1st this year. The Hospital Price Transparency Rule, managed by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, requires individual hospitals to provide clear pricing information online about the services they provide. The information must be posted in a file format that can be imported or read into a computer system, also known as a machine-readable file. Hospitals must also include standard pricing for at least 300 services, ranging from colonoscopies to CAT scans. Hospitals are not required to disclose prices for emergency services under the new rule. The rule is designed to allow consumers to compare prices and estimated costs of services. It can also help patients make more informed decisions about care, increase hospital competition, and potentially drive down costs. Non-compliant hospitals can face steep penalties, up to $2 million a year until they share pricing information in compliance with the new requirements. For their study, the researchers also looked at compliance among the country's 305 hospital referral regions. The researchers found that in 194 hospital referral regions, or 64%, more than half of hospitals were not compliant with the new disclosure requirement. All hospitals in 20 referral regions were compliant. On the contrary, all hospitals in 26 regions, including regions in Ohio, were non-compliant. And in some news about the high cost of prescription drugs, this from the American Heart Association, use of generic heart meds in Medicare Part D could save more than $600 million a year. A new analysis found that substituting generic cardiovascular medications for brand-name medications in the Medicare Part D prescription program could save more than $600 million per year in the U.S., including about $135 million in direct costs to patients. Researchers suggest that adjusting the prescribing patterns of about 8% of physicians who prescribe more brand-name cardiovascular medications than their peers could result in substantial savings. Yes, it would be good if physicians could incorporate price consciousness into their practices. And in other heart news, this from Medical Express, decline in heart disease death rates slowed from 2011 to 2019. From 2000 to 2011, the age-adjusted heart disease death rate in the United States decreased 3.7% per year. However, the decline slowed to 0.7% per year during 2011 to 2019, according to a December data brief published by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention National Center for Health Statistics. Although heart disease remains the leading cause of death, this report's findings are consistent with the long-term trend in heart disease death rates. Heart disease death rates declined rapidly beginning in the mid-60s, but that decline slowed in the 2010s. Okay, well, let's try to end news reporting with a couple better news stories. This from Medical Express. U.S. infant mortality reached historic low in 2019. In 2019, infant mortality reached a historic low in the United States with a death rate of 5.58 infant deaths per 1,000 live births, according to a December 8th National Vital Statistics Report, a publication from the CDC. In 2019, the five leading causes of infant deaths were the same as in 2018. Congenital malformations, disorders related to short gestation and low birth weight, maternal complications, sudden infant death syndrome, and unintentional injuries. Okay, and last but not least, this is a milestone piece of research out of Canada from Science Daily. Prescribing the abortion pill without restrictions is safe and effective, study finds. Abortion remains safe after Canada removed restrictions on the medical abortion pill mifepristone in November 2017. Canada was the first country in the world to remove all supplemental restrictions on the dispensing and administration of mifepristone. Many of the restrictions that Canada removed are still mandated by countries around the world, including the U.S. Our study is a signal to other countries that restrictions are not necessary to ensure patient safety, says Professor Wendy Norman, the study's senior author and professor of the University of British Columbia's Department of Family Practice. There is no scientific justification for mifepristone restrictions, which only make it harder for people to access the care they need. Canada's experience offers a roadmap for other countries on how to safely improve access to family planning services. The findings reveal that the uptake of medical abortion, those performed using medication rather than surgically, was rapid following the change in policy. Before mifepristone became available, 2.2% of abortions were provided using medication. That percentage rose to 31.4% 2 years after the drug became available as a normal prescription. At the same time, the overall abortion rate continued to decline after restrictions were removed, decreasing from 11.9 to 11.3 abortions per 1,000 female residents aged 15 to 49. We saw that patients and their healthcare providers rapidly began choosing medical abortion, which can sometimes be preferred over surgical methods by offering care closer to home and earlier in pregnancy, said study co-author Dr. Sheila Dunn. As other studies have shown, making abortion more accessible does not increase the number of people seeking abortion. We found the abortion rates continue to decrease after mifepristone's availability as a normal prescription. By linking and analyzing government health data on a secure data platform, through a nonprofit research institute in Ontario, the researchers produce a complete picture of abortion health outcomes that they say provides the best data available on abortion safety. So particularly with abortion becoming nearly illegal in the United States and perhaps completely illegal at some point, if the Supreme Court keeps up the trends it's signaling so far, mifepristone could be something that states and potentially women, I don't know what you do with like mail order and stuff between states, but it's one thing that potentially could offer easy access to health care, which is needed abortion services. Okay, well, there's never a shortage of public health news, and we have some bonus articles that you can read online. I'll give the link at the end of the list. This week, we have 11 articles. First up, Beyond Omicron, What's Next for COVID's Viral Evolution? A good deep read if you're interested in such things. Number two, boosters can help end the COVID pandemic. The extra shot doesn't mean that vaccines are ineffective. Our bodies just need a reminder. Three, vaccine skepticism is healthy. Cynicism is not. Four, a field guide to recognizing scientific disinformation. Five, how local leaders can create socially connected communities. Six, the role of arts in public health capturing interest. Health programs, community projects tap into creative side. And seven, an interesting one for nutrition, junk food in the brain, how modern diets lacking in micronutrients may contribute to angry rhetoric. There were some classic studies that were done like in prisons when you gave people better food, you had less like assaults and all that kind of stuff. So this is a very interesting article. Eight, why addressing racism against black women in healthcare is key to ending the U.S. HIV epidemic. Nine, millions of Americans struggle to pay their water bills. A national water aid program could help. 10. The national infrastructure bill makes historic investments in water cleanup. And 11. Some good news. 5 environmental victories from 2021 that offer hope. You can read these and other stories at toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-